Join us as we cover many an insane movie and numerous cult TV phenomenons. Are you ready to get jacked up? Are you with us? Then listen on. Gents, got another returning guest. Martial artist Braden D. White is back with a vengeance.
What's that? What's happening, guys?
Founder of TKO Productions, here to this martial arts franchise, the best of the best, along with the substitute. To that, we got co-reviewer Jonathan Mark from the Action Elite. How are you?
I'm good.
All right. So, long story short, both these movies are quadrilogies, four-parters. Best of the Best came out in the 80s. It was just one of many action dramas that was similar to The Karate Kid and Rocky and starred stuntman Philip Ree, his stuntman brother Simon Ree as the opponent, and Eric Roberts with long hair. And
let's be real. The ponytail was the star of the movie. Let's be real.
That's pretty much the star. Yeah. Rocky's gloves were the star in Rocky, and Eric Roberts' hair was the star in Best of the Best. Yeah.
No doubt.
And The Substitute starred Platoon and Sniper franchise star Tom Berenger. It's later followed by three sequels where he was replaced by a new character played by Treat Williams of Hair and Deep Rising fame. So it's pretty similar to Toy Soldiers, maybe even Commando and Death Wish. It's just a fun mercenary turned, you know, just posing as a substitute teacher and stopping a crime-ridden school in like a random suburb area. So they're both very fun, lowbrow, just actioners, just downright fun. So, Braden, when you got introduced to a lot of these, you know, late 80s, early 90s movies, did you watch these when they were initially out or just years after the fact, like on cable TV?
Well, I will tell you that the first one that I saw out of the best was number 3.
Oh, nice.
Because what I would do when I was anywhere from ages 10 to 13 is my dad had satellite TV, so I would actually search TV shows by keywords.
Nice.
And so I would search like karate, kung fu, martial arts, martial artists. And that one popped up and it happened to be playing, so I watched it.
That makes sense. That and part 4 were on FX cable quite a lot.
Yeah. And so number 3 was the first one I watched. And at that point, I was just looking for a kick-ass karate movie to watch. I didn't know that there was more to them. And then probably a couple of years later, my dad was flipping through channels and he told me that I would like this movie, but I didn't know what it was because all I saw was five dudes in a locker room. So I thought it was like a football movie or something.
Yeah.
And then I heard James Earl Jones famously playing Coach Frank Couzeau in the first one.
Yes. He says,
"You are the U.S. National Karate Team." And I was like, oh, karate movie. Okay, we on to something now. And nice. I would say that was right around the time, because I was 11 years old. Actually, no, I was 8 years old when I knew that I wanted to do karate movies.
Nice.
And I would say I was probably like 9, 10 maybe, because I didn't start taking karate until I was 10. but I'd always had an interest in it from the time I was like 5 years old, because my older brother got me into like Power Rangers and Ninja Turtles and stuff like that.
Right.
But I was the only one who gained the interest for the martial arts, like, like a genuine love for the martial arts. And so I started studying karate when I was 10. And essentially, that's all I took karate for. I mean, it did eventually grow into a genuine love of the martial arts. But at first, I just wanted to learn karate so I could do karate movies. But yeah, my first interaction with them, to answer your question, the short version is I wasn't around when they first came out, except for like number four. Because the first one came out in 89, the second one came out in 91, the third one came out in 93, and I think the fourth one came out in 96. And so I wasn't around when they were initially out. So yeah, I watched them on cable TV. And then eventually I got all these like action 20 packs that they always had 3 and 4. They never had 1 and 2.
Yeah, because Fox owned part one. And
yeah. But I've seen all four of them. So, and I actually have some fun behind the scenes tidbits, because through my time, my relatively short time in the film industry, I've met a couple people that have worked on a couple of these films, whether they be stunt guys or just extra hands on set.
You mean Garrett Warren?
No, I have not.
I know he's the eye patch guy, but it's interesting because he's like giant second unit director on a bunch of James Cameron's movies.
Yeah. I mean, I know who he is. I haven't met him. Like a lot of these people, when I say I've met them, like it's only been in passing and in conversation. Like I haven't really struck a friendship with anybody. But but once we dive more into the discussion, I have some behind the scenes stories that I'd like to share that I've heard.
Sure thing.
Through other people.
Totally. So I saw part one years ago on YouTube and I fell in love with it because it was just a fun, feel good movie. John, what were the themes that you took away from this on your viewing of it more recently?
Well, for me is, well, that was an interesting story, and yeah, and characters that I'd say were not only likable but also relatable, particularly with Eric Roberts. Right there, that I feel it showcases one of his best performances he's given in his entire career.
Totally. And it's just an easygoing crowd pleaser, yeah. And it's a shame that, I mean, Philip Rhee, after these movies, he did like a few other films and then just disappeared. And he said years later in an interview, he just decided to become like a visual effects animator or something like that. It's like, man, dude, it's cool that you got that. But I mean, what could have been, you know, you could have still made some mainstream movie appearances or something. You know,
he could have been, I feel like he would have had a strong presence if he would have joined like PM Entertainment. Along with Gary Daniels and Jeff.
Totally. He could appear in anything with Daniels and Speakman, Wincott, even see Thomas Howell. You know, just be with one of those action stars and just do a fun movie that's filled with nonstop car chases and explosions that's on TNT.
For sure.
But yeah, it's really fun. And then, you know, part two, that was technically the first one I saw of the bunch. I used to be a rapid share addict, so I saw all kinds of movies. And, you know, this kind of went for kind of more of a blood sport, lethal weapon kind of approach. And part three, like you say, was kind of, you know, retook over the franchise. And at that point, kind of went for more of a fun Jackie Chan.
Of just a bona fide action movie, more so than related to the first two.
Yeah.
Like it's only related to the first two by the name and the character that Philip Rhee plays. Yeah. Those are really the only connections. You could have put anybody else in that scenario, and I feel as long as they were equally as skilled as Philip Rhee, I feel like it would have done the same thing and it would have been a success.
100%. It's basically what he went for is just another fun town gets taken over kind of neo-western, and the rest is an excuse for him to do some fun visual gags.
Exactly.
Part four is basically Die Hard at an airport. You know, he's a fugitive on the run. He's running around. But I really love how he films some of the fight scenes, despite the very obviously low budget here. And, you know, obviously, you know, Ernie Hudson owns, you know, just.
Yeah. And if I remember correctly, I think this was filmed on like a third of the budget that the first Best of the Best had.
I wouldn't doubt it, because, I mean, you see a lot of oversaturated lights, so you're like, okay, it's pretty low budget. Yeah,
oversaturation, and obviously the locations are a lot more minimal in terms of size. You don't have, like, anything extravagant.
Pretty much. And Tobinville, you know, not into torture porn like, you know, Saw, but this is years before he was kind of a big go-to name, just playing big bads in various other movies and shows, and did really reasonable with the role. Just, you know, just playing a bunch of hunting games, and he's just like, yes, but I'm at a greater match. So like, that allows it to be a little taut before it gets to the predictable, you know, everyone, you know, gets in nonstop car chases and shootouts. That,
yeah.
They're well filmed. It's just one of those we've seen it too many times, so there's not many surprises.
But. Yeah, it's actually very, like, if you're to break it down to its core, it is very, very generic.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that we've seen 100 times in some way, shape, or form. But I still think that the action stands on its own 2 feet, because I found number four at a time when my personal aesthetic was starting to change in terms of how I like to see my action. Because when I was a teenager, particularly in my high school years, I was a real big fan of, like, extreme martial arts, you know, like Scott Atkins doing the Boyka stuff with the flips and the tricks. And I was real heavy into that. And then when I found number four is when my aesthetic started to change. And I started realizing, you know, that the way that Philip Ree was setting up these fights was, this is actually what could possibly happen if a skilled martial artist was attacked in a grocery store, if he was attacked in his home. And that's what really started to change my aesthetics in terms of how I view my action. And in a roundabout kind of way, it influenced my action for when I did Skin Circuit 2 years ago.
Very nice. And it also helps that, you know, Reed kind of keeps his, I don't want to make it sound like he has an over-the-top ego, but you feel like there's something for everybody. Like, all the characters matter. They're not just a shooting gallery or just there to, you know, be captured. And it's kind of cool how he films his upside-down, you know, interrogation scene where he's trying to visualize how he'll escape when he's got virtually nothing to work with, no knife, nothing.
Yeah.
And like you say, I mean, these movies, you know, they wore out their welcome, but at the same time, they were still a kind of a success on video and inspiring. And
that's actually part of the behind the scenes story that I was mentioning. Number four was basically came out of demand. I forget who owned the rights to the company or to the franchise at the time, but that person called up Philip Ree and said, we want a Best of the Best Four. And he was like, what? He's like, yeah, we want a Best of the Best Four. He's like, I was going to leave it at three. I don't even have an idea or have a script. And they're like, okay, we'll tell you, we'll make this easy for you. We'll give you X amount of millions of dollars. You write us a script. You can direct it and produce it.
That's nice.
And then two months later, he had a script and then 4 months later after that, they were shooting.
Pretty straightforward, right? I know Eric Roberts was quoted somewhere saying it would have been better had he returned. I don't think it made any difference of him leaving. You know, it's just such a different movie, you know?
I think it was a smart decision for him to come back for the second one just to continue the story. But as for the third and the fourth, like you said, I don't really feel like it made any kind of difference.
Not totally. I mean, and it's like, they were just such different plots, you know. And
honestly, I can't think of a way. The only way I could see Eric Roberts making a return is like if he would have came back in the third one and played the sheriff.
That would have been interesting, or that
had been the only way I could see him coming back and it making sense.
And I mean, they killed Chris Penn, you know, in part two, and it is like,
yes,
it would be like if everyone on the team had to come back. It's like, well, what's the point? Literally,
yeah,
they either died or they thought to get out of the fighting business because they're feared for their lives, you know. It's just like,
or whatever. Yeah,
what would his whole connection to it all be, like you say, unless he chose like some kind of authority figure?
That'd be the only way that I could see it making sense, is if he were
a cop or private eye.
Yeah, if you know Alex Grady retired from competition for the second time, and he became the sheriff of that small town.
And I think Philip, he was mainly just studying all the actors on set to become a better actor, you know.
Agreed.
He was basically, because his performance, his brother. Yeah.
Yeah, but his for not really being a trained actor per se, he did have some roles before Best of the Best, and I think in a way that kind of prepped him to make Best of the Best, because he does have a solid acting performance in that series of movies.
Only even his brother, who's mostly stuck to being a coordinator, you know, does good, yeah, as the opponent.
I mean, I think his brother has a total of like 4 lines in the entire 90-minute movie.
Right. You would disrespect my honor.
Yeah, and then that whole spiel he gives at the end of the movie, which, right, will bring a tear to your eye, honestly.
I can't think of any martial artist who hasn't seen it, whether they liked it or not, that still was...
It's on the list somewhere.
Somewhere, yeah. And it's so wild how it survived multiple generations. Someone has discovered it one way.
It still holds up. I remember... when it was first put on Netflix, I was at karate class, and my sensei actually recommended everyone to watch it. And I was like, well, I'll own it on DVD. Plus, I watched it on Netflix the other night. So,
right. Are you kidding? And it is one of those. It is kind of just one of those that just has always just come up in some fashion. I've seen people mention Lionheart for Van Damme. I've seen people who want to get into Mark Dacascos mention Only the Strong.
Yeah.
Just one of those other just fighting competition movies. If you're not watching what's on the video store or on TV, if you weren't necessarily even watching a lot of the Karate Kid type franchises, it's like, well, then you probably are seeing this in some capacity.
Yeah, I mean, it survived multiple generations, and I mean, sure, you know, kids might watch and be like, man, this movie's old, but like the story and hell, even the fight scenes still hold up.
And they matter. You feel every punch. And like you say, they're training to try and, you know, win this tournament. So again, you know, this is where we go back to Rocky. We have enough motivation to want to root for them to succeed at this, because this means more than just, you know, being a champion. It also means just, again, that they come this far at this stage in their lives.
Correct.
Sometimes just the basic stuff is just enough to motivate one. So yeah, I mean, part two, a lot of people shit on that one. I don't see the problem. I really don't.
I thoroughly enjoyed number two. I mean, yeah, it was a little bit more out there and it was a little bit more fantastical, but I see what they were trying to do. They tried to expand the world a little bit by introducing some of Tommy's family. And they also introduced several other martial arts styles in terms of broadening the horizons of the action sequences. And they even had they brought in the bo staffs for fight sequences.
So true. They're very creative, because this time, you know, they're out in the open. They have to actually kill.
Yes, you know?
And Philip does a neat, if I'm not mistaken, neck break.
Yes, he does.
And Eric is having to do more hiding and stealth. And Patrick Kilpatrick, let's face it, he's a good villain actor in anything. So
he is. I mean, people always ask me, you know, when I talk about Patrick Kilpatrick, I'm like, any movie in the '90s that you've ever seen, he's the bad guy.
Yeah, practically.
That's true.
Practically. I mean, and he's also one of the connections to the Substitute franchise, but we'll get there. And I mean, with the villains, I think they work better than, say, even just typical Rambo or Karate Kid type villains, because it's like they want more than just, you know, it's not just a measuring contest. It's also just like, you know, you're going to snitch about our illegal operation. And fun fact, Kane Hodder, that's right, Jason himself from Friday the 13th, you know, he's a stuntman. So he's in all four of these movies, always playing different characters. He's always, he's the rude bar fly in part one. In part two, he's one of the bouncers who gets knocked out outside there. And part three and four, he just has individual, you know, terrorist or henchman roles. So
yeah.
But it's fun to spot for genre people.
You know, I never even really noticed that, but now that you pointed out, like, I see it now. But I never put two and two together before, mainly because I'm just so lost in the action.
Yes, it does. Well, it says a lot about the movie. It does good at just staging it. You know, it's like early Steven Seagal before he became kind of a prima donna, where he's just like, yeah, it's pretty solid staging. It's going to appeal to all kinds of audiences, where they want a Lethal Weapon type movie or a Death Wish kind of film, but with martial arts, you know?
Exactly. But, and of course, I mean, you got to think of it at its core. It was made by martial artists for primarily martial artists.
Yeah. And
but at the same time, everyone there's bits and pieces of all of them that anybody can enjoy.
Yeah, there's something for everybody. And what the sensei, you know, James Earl Jones says in part one is hardly silly fluff to spread out, you know, in between. You actually are interested in just as much of the training as you are.
Oh, 100%. 100%. Like, matter of fact, there's a lot of martial arts movies where I enjoy some of the training sequences more so than I enjoy some of the fight scenes.
Yeah. Yeah, getting there, you already know how it ends. And so yeah, it's like you want to see how they got there.
Yeah. And then, you've seen Skin Circuit, so I'm sure you know I have a very typical martial arts movie montage at the very beginning.
Yes, you do.
And I did that for two reasons. I did that because I don't like movies where the hero, especially in fight movies, I don't like it when the hero is just a badass and you have no idea where he got these skills from. He just opens up the film and he's kicking ass everywhere.
Right. Or he gets defeated in the first round and he's just losing his shit. Oh, what did I do wrong? I'm like, come on. No. More than that. Don't be a whiner.
And I also don't like it whenever they just come out and say, I know karate. I know taekwondo.
Yeah. No fair doing Neo and Matrix. I know kung fu.
Yeah. No, we don't need any of that. So that was the purpose behind that scene, was I wanted to establish that my character had a martial arts background without him saying it in the dialogue.
Totally. Don't rely on over editing. Don't rely on, like you say, just.
Mine was pretty sweet and to the point. We filmed like four sequences, and we were just chopped them up and edited them into different places. I did one of my katas. I busted out some nunchucks for a minute, and I was working on the bag. And I mean, we did that in a matter of a couple hours.
It's not bad. It's on point in many ways. And in many ways, I think it's harder to find more martial artists who want to do a movie for martial arts, and just the general public, just trying to make everyone happy. It's like, have plausible use of the art, and then, like you say, have a story that fascinates you, that isn't preachy, that isn't overlong, and connects it all.
Which is something that I feel like not only does this series of films, The Best of the Best, they do it well, because not only are they martial arts movies and action movies for it, not only was it made for that particular audience, but several of the cast and crew members were members of that audience as well. And that's the best filmmaking advice I've ever got. Don't make movies that you think are going to be successful. Make movies that you would want to watch.
Yeah. I mean, more or less. I mean, if you have nothing else to go on, you know, stop getting annoyed by, you know, early screenings or people misinterpreting stuff. The right, you know, it's like a many comedians will say, the right people get it.
Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much this film is like the epitome of that, because you can tell they weren't written for the masses. They were written for a very niche audience, and that particular niche audience has embraced it in its fullest.
Totally. I think so, especially at this rate. Because again, as we mentioned, we've always seen it on some kind of list somewhere.
It's always somewhere, whether it's on a Throwback Thursday on a cable TV network, or like the first one is on Netflix.
I saw it on the Outdoor Channel one time, or
exactly
Sports Channel. I'm sure it's been on ESPN. I've even seen...
I'm pretty sure it was on like Spike TV or ESPN or something like that.
Had to be. And different programming then, but still pretty interesting. And like you say, I mean, I've even seen Eric's final scene be listed as one of the best crying scenes in movies because people get it.
Yeah. And also, you know, it like going back to it reaching several audiences, you know, 3 and 4 always end up on the action packs by Echo Bridge. And I don't think I own several of those action packs, and Best of the Best 3 and 4 are in most of them.
Totally. So, I mean, an altogether pretty easy to get into franchise. And people who aren't even into maybe say low budget direct to video films will still take away something fun from it, because it's just very inspired.
I would go so far as to say that you don't even have to be a martial arts fan to enjoy these movies, because at the core, especially the first one isn't a martial arts movie. It's more of like a sports drama in the same vein as like Rudy or Facing the Giants or something like that, or We Are Marshall. It has that same kind of tone in terms of overcoming an obstacle with a team to achieve a common goal. To me, it's not really, the first one especially, is not a martial arts movie. 2, 3, and 4 are more so what I would consider your typical martial arts movie, but the number one I would consider more of a sports drama in the terms of like I said, Rudy, Facing the Giants, We Are Marshall, in that kind of vein.
That's fine. I like to consider a lot of sports action some variation on action, kind of like war or Western, but
yeah,
to me, where it's more of a drama with some fighting in it. But yeah, I mean, they're just easygoing crowd pleasers, like you say. And I mean, those who don't like it will either be, you know, be very critical of what they consider a good martial arts movie, or just maybe not a fan of Eric. I don't know. That's the only reason I can think someone would want to avoid it.
Yeah. And I think Eric Robert gets a lot of unfair hate.
Well, and especially because he was just straight up. He was going to star in all kinds of movies and just, I mean, you can't say he doesn't disappear into some roles. And nowadays I see some people making fun of how he's kind of Mr. Cue Card, so to speak. He doesn't know any of his lines typically, and he kind of comes to set not really caring what he's in. But I think that's just it. He's just at that point where he's just like, I make ends meet. I can do whatever I want at this point. You know, I love
to act. He's a bankable name to where if you were to get him in a low budget production, it would definitely sell some DVDs. But like you said, it's at the point to where he's doing it to still say that he's an actor.
Yeah.
He's not working at a bar. He's not a busboy at a restaurant. He's making his living acting, and I think that's why he comes in and does a lot of these low budget movies that a lot of us would consider trash.
All right. One person's filth is another person's treasure, you know.
Exactly.
And then I probably wouldn't care either if I'd been pretty established and gotten a reasonable cult audience and be like, okay. Starting whatever. People exactly. Want to work with me in some capacity. So
exactly.
So speaking of actors, this is kind of another connection to The Substitute. It's just, had you seen any of the Sniper movies or other films that Tom Berenger was in?
Me?
Yeah.
I've seen a couple of the Sniper movies. I saw Sniper Legacy, where it was kind of a passing the torch. I saw the first Sniper way back in the day. I don't even remember a lot of it, but I do remember watching it with my dad.
It's just another one of those obscure cable TV movies.
Yeah. But I do remember watching Sniper Legacy, where it's kind of the passing the torch between Tom Berenger to Ryan Phillippe.
I've been really impressed by those. I would watch the first three quite a lot on Spike TV.
Yeah.
All of them were very interesting in that they kind of had this Mission Impossible, Bourne Identity, Taken kind of mentality to them. Just,
yes.
You know, just infiltrate and then get out of there. Get the hell out of there and just create it with sniping. And you could suspend belief on whether or not they were using action, because it was kind of a more serious version of A-Team kind of. You know, just
Yes.
Do just fun, just infiltration. And they're already on number 8 now. And I can honestly say, I mean, Tom's a good actor, never phones in a performance, in my opinion. He's been struggling lately because, kind of like Luke Goss, he kind of just keeps getting movies that are just way too micro budget for him, you know, just don't have much of a story or purpose for his role for that instance. So it just kind of feels just like a waste of time, unfortunately. But he still does those. He was on the show Major Crimes, and he was really dramatically good on that. Yeah, no, I mean, he's just another one of those. He's just been kind of a go-to for a while, just either being the romantic lead or the military guy or the cowboy, and he just kind of vanished after a while, and I think he just wanted to do just easier stuff, like just be more laid back, and he already had a bunch of fans from Major League anyway, so I mean, I'm sure.
Yeah,
yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, the substitute just made sense, because here he wasn't having to try and be something you hadn't already kind of seen him in. Like,
yeah.
I think if they had made him be like a black belt or something, I'd have a little trouble buying that, because he just doesn't seem like he would have the build for that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think another, not talking down on the substitute movies, because like I said, from what I saw the first one, it was really enjoyable, but I was also trying to watch it while also take care of my stepson. So it was kind of hard to stay focused. But I think one of the major problems it has is it came out right at the time when there was a bunch of those troubled high school kind of movies, like Only the Strong, Lean on Me, those kind of movies.
Yeah, it's basically Dangerous Minds, but with martial arts.
Yeah, Dangerous Minds.
Not martial arts, just fighting and... here you got
action,
a principal who's involved in illegal drug smuggling and a bunch of other gangbangers. So,
yeah, like I said, I think that's the main problem that it has, is that it came out in the wrong time, because there's a lot of movies like that at the time where you had some sort of teacher that was trying to make a difference. Because, like I said, you had Only the Strong with Martin Dacascos, you had Lean on Me with Morgan Freeman. There was another one that I don't remember the name of at the moment.
Oh, 187 with Sam Jackson.
No, not that one. It was made in the 90s. It had Lou Diamond Phillips, and it was about a math teacher.
Oh, yes. Stand and Deliver. Yes.
Yes.
That was
Stand and Deliver.
One.
Yes. Stand and Deliver. That one.
This is kind of more like Toy Soldiers, kind of.
Yeah, more Toy Soldiers.
Yeah. But you see what I'm saying, though? Is it
totally.
It came out around the same time, within a couple years of all these movies. So it had a little problem. It had a little bit of a problem establishing its own identity.
I totally agree. Cause it was just like when the 2000s, there was like almost a war movie every year and like a dozen of them. And you're like,
Black Hawk Down, Saving Private Ryan, We Were Soldiers.
Yeah. And they're all back to back and they're being compared endlessly. I'm like, well, they're similar, but they're totally different apes. They're totally different entities, but it's hard to keep them because they're all doing similar kind of putting you in the middle of it visually, and you can't blame people for trying to try new things. And unfortunately, that's just how the business is set up. You gotta come out with something that's similar that other people might want to check out, and unfortunately that's where everything gets accused of being a copycat, even when it has good intentions. But yeah, I think I'm with you. Had this been like a Canon Films production or just some other kind of just...
It would have got so much more recognition.
Totally. It might have even changed it up to where there was a martial artist or like expand upon his special forces. Like, they would actually show you his dangerous rescue mission at the beginning. And
honestly, I feel like if this was made by Canon back in like the late 80s, I feel like David Bradley could have led it beautifully.
That would have been fun. And I mean, he's come a long ways. I mean, doing all sorts of movies, you know, the Red Dawn remake, Born Identity, Cradle of the Grave. So yeah, that would totally make sense for me if he was had been like a second unit director on it or something. But yeah, I mean, I always would see parts of these movies. Part four was like the first one I saw part of, and I was interested. Yeah, it was just, they all premiered on the HBO stations, you know, nonstop, and just were played on USA Network. And it's just, they were just some of those kinds of movies that just, you just kind of accepted them for what they were. You could kind of buy Treat as a badass, even though, you know, he was kind of looking his age like Harrison Ford at that point. And part two, I think, struggled because they just hired a comedy filmmaker and it just wasn't the best intro. I liked that there's a connection, like there's some of the same gangbangers and military guys working with Treat. So there is a bit actual, somewhat of a loose connection. And I think the main issue is the villains just aren't as cool as Ernie Hudson's, you know, Crooked Principal. Yeah. And, you know, there's the best four connection, but he did those both around, like around the same time. But it was interesting how, you know, you can kind of see something like this happening. And I love how at the end they're all fighting each other and it's all a bunch of silenced pistols. So you're like, okay, so they got a little while before the cops or neighbors complain, you know, about the noise. And I mean, I mentioned this with other action fans. It kind of goes for that whole Punisher Warzone kind of mentality, which is kind of ironic because apparently there is a comic book kind of where the Punisher does go undercover as a high school teacher.
I actually didn't know that.
In one issue. So it's like, yeah, it, like you're saying, Braden, it could be a little, it could have come out way earlier and probably hit way more marks, no pun intended. And but I mean, I like the cast in the first one. Okay. You have William Forsythe from The Rock and Devil's Rejects. You got Raymond Cruz from Under Siege and was also in the Closer franchise with Behringer. But,
with Guzman as well.
Yeah. Guzman is good. And you also got, what's his name? Glenn Plummer from Speed. You know, he was really good as one of the teachers who gets killed for knowing too much. And so it's just like, okay. So this is a pretty stuck up, you know, inner city school, and you know, you can have fun with the fact that you know that every other scene is going to lead to some intimidation and foreshadow another confrontation. Like, I love how he thinks he's going to get shanked in the library, so he has a bunch of different books as his shield, you know. But yeah, I mean,
like, don't talk in the library.
Yeah. That was so hysterical. He's like, he's kicking his ass, like, don't talk in the library. So there's, it wins in the one-liners department, and it knows what it is without just going on way too long. I love how they run him off the road, and he just is crawling out like, of all the things, I thought it was going to be much worse, you know? So yeah, I think part two struggles with that. It was trying to get a little too comfortable, and it just has too much unnecessary slow motion. But
I haven't seen number two, so I'm out of this part of the conversation.
No, it's all good. I dug B.D. Wong from Jurassic Park and Law and Order. He was really good as the bad guy, but again, he doesn't have as much screen time, so he's kind of underused. But
yeah, he really is.
Part three, I think, at least should be at least number two in the franchise because it just owns. It totally gets to business, and again, just. Everyone seems like they're having so much fun. They're very creative with how they take down the various gangs and do a bunch of, you know, put up some cameras during their stings. And Claudia Christian from Babylon 5 is really good as on the right hands. And this is as martial arts as it gets. They have another guy, James Black, who was in movies like Soldier and a bunch of other TV shows. He has some very cool sword play in between the gunplay. So it's like, okay. So now, finally getting way more creative. Now part four, this is where it's really the most connected to Best of the Best. Patrick Kilpatrick is the main
villain,
white supremacist military guy. So what would otherwise feel like an episode of, you know, NCIS, you know, or JAG, and basically, yeah, he's a pretty just out of his mind, you know, military guy. He's got to be investigated, and Simon Rhee is his right hand, you know, military guy who's killing some of the soldiers who are mouthing off. And again, it embraces its lowbrow or the top frills and just has fun with it. It's just, you know, Treat had some fun, clever ways for how he was getting away from them. Like just, you know, when he uses that construction equipment, that was probably the best scene to get past the gun, you know, gunmen. They're all just very well configured. They never pretended to be anything else that they were. And, you know, I miss blockbusters that had fun with just deliberately over the top. Instead, they now seem to just go for absurd and not know what they really are. You know, they kind of have a Roland Emmerich kind of book, and you're like, well, how should I even respond? This is just too random. I don't know how to respond, you know?
That's true.
And I love how it just, again, you know, Braden already summed up how Best of the Best was just fun, and John's just been summing up how you really just can't lose. There's just something for everybody, so.
That's one thing that both of these, even though I haven't seen the Substitute series, like I've seen enough like via trailers and stuff like that, and I've seen all the Best of Best. And one thing that they
trailers both were cool, do, weren't they?
Yeah, but one thing that both of this series of movies do is they completely own the fact that they are low budget. They never try to pretend to be a multi-million-dollar picture. And they do it beautifully.
Wasn't Substitute 1, I think, made for like 10,000 or something? 10,000. Maybe 2 million. But yeah, it was pretty low budget. So it was just like, yeah. This, I think, was showing when studios like, again, you know, Dimension Films and Lionsgate, they could just come up with something that was easy to entertain. And like you say, Braden, you know, the trailers were just eye-catching. You're like, you know, I might just see that. It just seems like a fun time.
And nowadays you have trailers that give you the whole movie and you're like, I don't even need to watch the movie now.
Because they don't even do the in-studio anymore. Now they give it to a company whose job is to sell the movie, you know, by creating trailers. And it's like, but you gave it all away.
That's something that I'll talk about it more in a little bit, but I feel like that's a little bit of a deficit in the entertainment industry right now.
Totally. Totally. I mean, as you say, you know, it is one of those where you just gotta sit back and relax and just watch the high kicks and gunplay emerge. It's just fun.
And just have fun with it.
Yeah, have fun with it.
You know, it's these are the type of movies that you just turn on and you just spend 2 hours losing your mind.
Right? Totally. I mean,
and there's nothing fun, wrong with that.
So why shouldn't you? Yeah. It's never like a closed off party where they're having fun, but they forgot to invite you, you know?
Oh no. Like you turn on the movie and you just go crazy for 2 hours and then the movie's over and then you're like, oh man, my rent's due tomorrow. It takes you out of reality for a little bit. And
this is the movie I want to watch after I've done all my taxes for the year.
Yes.
And you just, you know, I just feel like a lot of that is missing. And now every movie now seems to just, it seems like if you want to give it an audience, it basically has to be similar to John Wick or something. And it's like, okay, John Wick's fucking awesome.
I have nothing against John Wick, but you have too many movies that use that as its namesake. You know, I've seen so many action movies over the last, especially last 3 years, that's from the producers of John Wick, from the same director as John Wick. The studio
that brought you the Expendables.
Yeah.
In the style of Man on Fire.
Like I'm talking specifically John Wick, though. I've seen too many movies that have used that to try and sell. Like you have Peppermint with Jennifer Garner. You have Nobody with Bob Odenkirk, which I'm not going to lie, that's probably my favorite one.
Yeah, even The Protégé, which couldn't be any different.
The Protégé is completely different than John Wick.
Right. It is.
The only thing that's similar is the style of action. But in terms of story and everything, they couldn't be any more different.
And it's like John Wick is kind of going for a similar attitude, like The Substitute, of just creating a fictional world and, you know, in exchange for gunfire and, you know, over the top, you know, creative ways to kill every opponent. But like you say, they're also different in that, you know, The Substitute is like way deeper, not deeper, but way quicker. And Wick is kind of going for a comic book kind of, you know, fictional universe on its own. Mm-hmm. Like Sin City, they said was like one of the influences, and critics have noted how the neon lighting kind of feels like Collateral or something, you know? So,
yeah.
But yeah, like you say, it doesn't all have to be the same. And like, and I mean, Liam Neeson kind of can't get away from it. I mean, he's doing some fun action movies, he's doing some other duds, but every time everyone just feels like it's kind of like with Charles Bronson when he was doing Death Wish. It's like everything was instantly compared to Death Wish, and so everything mm-hmm. Neeson does is compared to Taken.
Exactly. Exactly. You know?
Everything Stallone and Dolph Lundgren are trying out and is often,
how's it different from Rocky? How's it different from doing Rocky IV?
Right. It's an Expendables type cast. And it's like, well, kind of, but it's more just in the vein of, if anything, the Expendables made it possible for this to be a bigger market or just prove that.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's like, but yeah, when you say something is like a movie, it's like you're kind of implying it's like the story. And so, like you say, it's like, no. Someone clearly didn't see the movie because they're not at all.
Yeah.
Like at least say in the style of, you know.
Which, you know, I have no problem saying it because I'll openly admit it. What Expendables tried to do with bringing together all these action stars is something that I actively tried to do with my film Double Cross. Shameless plug.
That's all good. That's why you're here. And, I mean, who wouldn't want to work with some fun martial artists and do a fun movie, you know?
I mean, and that was basically the point was, you know, I knew several martial artists that were trying to get into acting. And so I was like, well, let's put us all in a movie together and just give everyone their chance to shine. Whether we lose the fight, win the fight or whatever, we all of us, like out of our six main characters, five of us know martial arts. So, I mean, I think the official count is we have 9 fight scenes in the movie.
Oh, wow.
I think.
Hmm. Well, okay. That's good. It's really good.
But like I said, I intentionally did that because Stallone was like, let's bring all these action people from the 90s and 80s together. And I was like, let's bring in some of my martial arts friends that are trying to do movies and put them in a movie together. So kind of the same mindset, just different sides of the spectrum. You know, Stallone's bringing in people that are quote unquote past their prime, and I'm bringing people that are up and coming. You know what I mean?
That essentially it. And I mean, that shields everyone in a way, you know what I mean? As opposed to someone, you know, working with one filmmaker who's not like doing what they need to do. Like Robert Bronzi is a stuntman and horse rider who's practically basing his whole career on looking and sounding like Charles Bronson.
Exactly.
And so that's his stick. He wants to do homage films that of earlier period of old school action. And I mean, Scott Atkins and Dolph fortunately have just such a loyal fan base because they try to do their best no matter what the project is or who the filmmaker is. And so like they got this upcoming spy movie called Section 8. Some people are bad-mouthing it because it was only filmed in 2 weeks. I'm like, still, that's one hell of a cast and interesting crew. So everyone's going to see it one way or the other.
If Scott Adkins is in the movie, it's immediately on my watch list. I can love it or hate it, but I'm at least going to watch it first.
Yeah. He's literally critic proof in a way. Yeah. He's like, and there's a reason he's become just a big hit around the, you know, limited release and video on demand crowd. He's just, you know, he's going to always play an unusual, you know, character with a cool backstory.
Yeah. And his last few outings that he had, you know, One Shot is probably one of the best action movies I've seen that's come out in the last 100 years. Castle Falls didn't really bring anything special to the table, but it was, like I said, it's one of those you can turn it on and just not think for 90 minutes.
Yeah. I saw some people comparing it to Assault on Precinct 13 and Trespass from 92, and it's like, it's kind of like that, but it's more...
It kind of is, but you got to think it's a COVID-era movie. They started filming, they were filming for a day and a half before COVID shut them down, and then they came back in October, and Tim Mann choreographed the fight scenes, but they weren't able to bring him back when they started filming due to COVID reasons. So they basically... Scott Atkins was the action director on that movie. They followed Tim Mann's choreography as best they could, but Scott Atkins, in terms of the action, he was the one behind the camera calling the shots.
Okay. Well, I mean, it could have, you know, I was worried for it because the minute it shut down, I was like, oh fuck. You know,
I was afraid for it too. Because I was afraid, honestly,
Scott was going to look frustrated because, you know, he's also an actor. He wants to make sure the character has a consistent fight scene and motivation to kick off.
I was just afraid that the movie was going to get canceled because, you know, all these big budget movies like Mission Impossible and The Batman, they were all getting shut down.
Yeah, and they were having COVID scares.
Yeah, they were having COVID scares and they were getting shut down indefinitely. They were getting shut down with the term indefinitely. And so I was like, well, shit, if these big ones can get shut down, then these little ones don't stand a chance.
I had some faith because didn't they film it in like North Carolina, I think?
Alabama.
And
which, if I would have been living in Virginia at that time, I would have made the 4-hour drive to Birmingham, Alabama. Totally. And I would have told these, like, hey, y'all don't know me, but Let me fight, okay? Just give me one scene.
Right.
I would have crashed the set. No shame.
Yeah. What do I got to do? Just, you know, show a cool stance and, you know, a few kicks that make you trust me, you know?
Yeah. I mean, what's stunt fighting? You show up, you throw some punches, you fall down.
And it is easier to get into some kind of movies if you can impress the stunt coordinators, you know? So
exactly. And, you know, I'm just going to take this time to plug my company just a little bit, but, with my company, what I look for in terms of, well, first thing with a lot of my first few projects that I'm putting out, I'm working with people that I've already worked with, whether it be we acted in the same movies before, or I have I've already established a relationship with them in some way. So I'm bringing in a lot of people that I know and that I trust. That I know will bring the action, or even my director, David Ferguson. We've been in a number of the same projects together, but we've never been on set at the same time.
Oh man, that's frustrating. So,
but we've established a friendship since right before I shot Skin Circuit. So we've been on good terms, and like I trust him behind the camera. Even, you know, I trust him a whole lot. But with my company, which I'm sure you know, Cam, I'm trying to bring back, TKO Productions, for those of you who don't know. I'm on all social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. We even have a YouTube channel. I just don't have anything on it yet. But as I'm sure you know, Cam, with following my page and all this, I'm trying to bring back the action movies from the 90s where you just needed to have good action. It had nothing to do with the editing or nothing like that. But it involved everything to do with
the person performing
the action. Yes. Yeah. And I think I'm doing a pretty good job with that.
And people Skin forget Circuit, we've come such a long way, you know, since the 70s where we had to worry about the cameras.
We really have. We really have. Now everything's
digital. So
it cuts down on costs of filming because you're not paying hundreds of thousands of dollars for rolls of film. You know, you can spend $60 on an SD card that'll hold 6 hours worth of footage.
Right. You can worry more about the entertainment now instead of
exactly.
Oh, and we need to fix something. No, we don't. It's got to get good sound and actors who can do their stunts.
But with that, it also with the technology becoming as advanced as it has, it's also created more competition. But I don't necessarily see that as a bad thing, because now all these filmmakers who didn't get the chance or couldn't afford to make the movies they wanted to make are now getting that chance, because you don't need millions of dollars to make a movie anymore. You know, you spend a couple thousand on a decent camera and you get some buddies together that kind of have an idea on how to act and throw a kick, and you can make a good action film. And I mean, like, for instance, my short Skin Circuit, if you haven't checked it out, check it out. It's on my YouTube channel. I shot that for between $600 and $800. And I just used what I had available to me, and we did the best that we could. And I think everyone looks back at their own stuff and they look at stuff that, you know, like, I watched the fight choreography and I'm like, oh, I should have done something different. But I'm really proud of what I came up with. And based on the feedback that I've been getting from it, I mean, we don't have a ton of views, but I feel like we've had a good enough
impression.
Yeah, right, I feel like I've made a good enough impression that I now feel confident moving forward with the feature-length version that I originally envisioned back in 2017. So I got that on the production list as well after Double Cross. Of course, I got Double Cross, which I plan to start shooting hopefully soon. I just got offered a new job, so I may have to change the shooting schedule just a little bit, but we're still going to hopefully have that filmed by the end of the year. And then I have, of course, like I said, me and my team, we feel confident going forward with the feature length version of Skin Circuit, and diving into that story a little bit more, getting more details. And then I'm working, I got another film being written called Dark Deal.
Nice.
It's kind of like your kind of like a 12 rounds kind of movie, you know. You have a character who's like an ex special operations for police who gets put into witness protection, and the crime boss he put away is now coming after him and saying, I'm going to kill your family if you don't do this for me. And so he has to make that dark deal in order to keep his family safe.
Well, that's just so it. You got to have the title be a word, you know, that's said.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't think I'm going to have him say it, but that's kind of where it comes from.
Or just describe it. Yeah.
From. Yeah. But think of like Eliminators with Scott Adkins meets Running Red with Jeff Speakman. And that's kind of what you get with Dark Deal. And then,
unfortunately, all these, you know, 90s DTV movies we grew up with are now on streaming. So someone's will had some exposure to it, to where they can even get some of the fun homages we made. Like,
exactly.
It's like, oh, that sounds like, this doesn't seem like Crank with Statham. This seems more like Drive with Mark Dacascos.
Exactly. And speaking of Drive, that's another, I have another feature film that I'm working on. It's in the treatment process, I would say. But my popular fight video, The Drive, that I put out in October of 2019 that I did with my buddy Levi, we are actually expanding that and trying to do that into a feature-length movie, but we're putting a twist on it. It's going to have a female lead, and instead of me being the hero like I was in the two-minute fight scene, I'm going to play the villain.
Sweet.
But we're expanding that. It's going to be a little bit sci-fi-ish, but still like a normal action movie, but there'll be some science fiction elements to it, but it'll still for the most part be an all-around action movie. And I still, like I said, I got three or four more other ideas that I'm not going to give away just yet, because I want to see how these four movies do first. But one thing I will say is, if the feature length of Skin Circuit does well and the short film continued to do well, we do have an idea for a sequel. So we will be, if Skin Circuit performs really well, we will be pursuing a sequel. So that is something that will happen, but the fans have to make it happen.
Right. It's only fair.
And like I said, you can follow updates on all these films on my social media for my production company.
Braden D. White, everyone.
Braden D. White on Braden White MA on Instagram and Twitter. You got Braden D. White is my personal page on Facebook. You can follow my production company on Twitter as TKO Productions at TKO Prods LLC. Same on Instagram, TKO Prods. That's PRODS Prods. TKO Prods LLC on Instagram and TKO Productions LLC on Facebook. Follow us on those and you'll be able to see updates. But Double Cross, I want to take a little bit of time to promote Double Cross just a little bit, because we did have a couple hiccups in the road. And I want to take this time to honor the memory of a very good friend of mine who was slated to play the villain of Rodriguez in Double Cross. His name is Master Louis Cruz. He was a 6-degree black belt Taekwondo master. He was a local martial arts legend in the area I lived in Oklahoma. And he owned one of the most successful dojos in the area teaching Taekwondo. And he had been running it successfully since 94.
Yep.
We are continuing to make this movie in memory of him because, like I said, he was slated to play the villain of Rodriguez, but he unfortunately passed away on November 21st of 2021. So we had had a couple fight scenes rehearsals with him, and he was just so excited to bring what he knew, because he, like I said, he knew various styles of martial arts. He was a 6-degree Taekwondo black belt. He had developed his own system based on Taekwondo that he described as Korean street fighting, and it was called Jongun San. And basically it was Korean combatives. And he also did Krav Maga and Muay Thai. But we were really looking forward to it. We had shared some ideas back and forth. Me and him were going to have the end fight, and we were really looking forward to having like a karate versus Taekwondo. But like I said, he was originally slated to play the character of Rodriguez before he passed away. But we do have somebody who is filling his shoes, who was a close friend of his by the name of Craig Blacklock. And he is a fight trainer, a Muay Thai instructor. He owns his own fight gym, you know, boxing, kickboxing, Valley Tudo. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what he brings to the table. Like I said, he was a close friend of Master Cruz, so he understands what this film means to us. And, you know, this film has a bunch of legitimate martial artists in it anyway. You know, you have myself. I'm a 2nd-degree black belt in Teashiru Jiu-Jitsu and Shotokan Karate, and as well as American Freestyle Karate. My boy Ezra Johnson is a black belt under kickboxing legend Bill Superfoot Wallace. Then you got my good friend Ethic Dijon, who is a 3-time world martial arts champion at the U.S. Open in Florida. And like I said, now we got Craig Blacklock, who's now playing the character of Rodriguez. He's a fight trainer and established martial artist himself. So the action is still going to deliver in this film. And like I said, we're going to start filming relatively soon, and we're hoping to have it done by the end of the year, and hope to have it out for public consumption sometime next year. And then, like I said, each movie that we do depends on the success of the previous. So if you want TKO to keep going, if you want TKO to make Double Cross, you got to support the short Skin Circuit. If you want the feature version of Skin Circuit, you have to support the short version plus Double Cross. If you want the film after Skin Circuit to do good, you got to promote all, you got to want all three. So sure. Like I said, I'm a martial artist and an actor and a filmmaker, and I'm making movies for the martial arts and action fans. And like I said, I'm really trying to do the fans justice, because I'm also a fan, you know, like I said before, make movies that you would want to see. And all these films that I'm making, I genuinely would buy the DVD.
Sure. Support the arts, guys. All right.
And anyway, that's my whole spiel. Follow me. Braden White, MA, TKO Productions. That's me.
For sure. Thank you for being on here.
Thank you.
We'll return after these messages.
Hey, feeling down? Feeling low? Not enough podcasts about movies in your life? Why not try?
They must be destroyed on sight!
the new podcast cure-all, sure to get you right with the world and on a path to better living. We have exploitation, we have Italian horror, we have zombies, we have slashers, we have crime films, we have spaghetti westerns, we even have sci-fi and sex comedies. So take a dose of...
They must be destroyed on sight!
As needed, and let the hosts, Lee Russell, Daniel Harper, Paul Romali, and the odd guest host cure what ails you.
Warning, may cause atrophy, African consumption, black fever, bone shave, chin cough, colic, cramp colic, dropsy of the brain, elephantitis, grocer's itch, jaundice, mania, miasma, mortification, palsy, Pott's disease, rheumatism, scurvy, St. Anthony's fire, summer complaint, and worm fit in some people. Consult a physician before listening.
Did you ever see a film at such a young age it left you traumatized with cinematic wounds?
Necrophilia.
It's a dead issue, man. Don't push it. Cinema Psyops is a weekly podcast documenting an ongoing experiment on the mind of an unwilling test subject.
No one should have to watch this movie.
Oh, no one should have to watch this?
No one should have to watch this movie.
Surprisingly, it's not a topic that a lot of people really want to tackle.
I'm shocked, prudes.
I know, really.
Right?
It's the next sexual frontier that no one wants to explore.
I am, in the most sincerest of senses, disappointed in you.
It takes a powerful goddess like Connie, jam her arm down the monster's throat and kill it. Oh, I'm still tripping out over that. Even as a kid, I was like, I gotta find a girl like that.
Every week, I get a new look of disappointment that I never thought I could get out of.
It's unimaginable. At 12 years old, you should not be watching this movie.
Obviously.
At 13, you should not be. 14, you shouldn't be. I'm not entirely sure even 17-year-olds should be watching this movie.
Just because you're offended by something doesn't mean that you have the right to demand that it doesn't exist.
Watching this film again, I had all of this like little nerd glee with everything that kept
little history
up.
Doll, yeah, popping up
absolutely.
At you.
So I totally loved this film.
Hey, I know why you couldn't see that. It's because your brain's warped watching this shit at 12 years old.
Yeah, this is a rough movie. I told you ahead of time when we were getting ready to do it that it was.
How
be
did
a rough
you watch
one.
This shit at 12?
Because physical wounds heal, cinematic ones don't. Listen to Cinema Psyops.
Hey everybody, I'm Corey
and I'm Zach. And we're the hosts of Podcasting After Dark, a cast dedicated to late-night horror and sci-fi of the 80s and 90s, often found on HBO and Cinemax.
You know, the movies your parents didn't want you watching as a kid. You can find us every other week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, and Stitcher.
This is what you want.
This is what you get.
Greetings, friends. My name is Dean Legiro, and I'm the host of the 3324 Podcast. I invite you to join me and my lifelong friend Eric Huber to come with us as we discuss the music and movies that shaped our life. Each week, we'll pick an album or film that we really connect to, and not only give you some great info and trivia, but also discuss, debate, and celebrate what it means to us and the journey it took us on. We also look forward to hearing from you and giving us some of your picks for us to check out and discuss. I think it'll be a really fun experience, so come along with us for the ride. You can find us on your favorite podcast provider, and at 3324.buzzsprout.com. Thanks for your time, and welcome to the 3324 family.
It's time, let's check our cue, baby. Pair it with a couple brews, baby. We love good movies. We love the bad ones, too. So we watch them all and pass their lessons on to you. Oh, yeah.
Everything I learned from movies helps to make life a little bit groovy. With a one-liner plot holes and gratuitous movies. It's time to get busy with your friend Steven Izzy.
At EILFM.podbean.com.
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening.
It's a Jacked Up Review Show.